Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with a little blues to introduce today's show, sharing the voices and impressive and creative work of community activists Molefe Mdlovo and Orlean Naidoo. If you've been listening to our shows recently, you'll know that Raising Sand Radio is recording in South Africa to bring you news and views affecting the folks in this part of the world, since what happens in the South affects those who live in the North and vice versa. Before we turn to Molefe Mdlovo and Orlean Naidoo, let's talk a little bit about the trend that South Africa is seeing called the blue light bullies. It's a growing culture of excessive police brutality. The Independent Complaints Directorate announced a year ago it would launch a full-scale probe into the bullying tactics of the South African Police Service's VIP Protection Unit following dozens of incidents, including in April 2007, a motorist used his cell phone in KwaZulu-Natal to film ANC KwaZulu-Natal Premier Sbu Ndebele's Blue Light Brigade, endangering other road users by traveling at 160 kilometers an hour in heavy traffic on the N3, which is a major freeway. In November of that year, KwaZulu-Natal resident Mike Allison was killed when a car in a blue light convoy smashed into his pickup at high speed. Allison had been involved in a collision with KwaZulu-Natal Arts and Culture Minister of Executive Committee Wezewe Tusi's police convoy. The accident happened at such high speed his son Mark said his father didn't stand a chance. A few months later, Allison's wife Tina Allison was allegedly blocked by a pickup with flashing blue lights at a local toll plaza. In 2008, Peter Driver, a 63-year-old Durban man, was allegedly punched a number of times and nearly concussed when he failed to make way for six men who had flashed their blue lights to try to get him out of his lane. In November 2008, Constable Noxumalo of the Alexandra Road, that's Pietermaritzburg Police Barracks, allegedly shot out the tire on a Mazda on also the N3, the freeway near Camperdown, a small town there. The driver of the car lost control, veered into oncoming traffic, and collided head-on with another pickup. There were six people in each car. Eight of them were injured. Noxumalo later said he was in a hurry to pick up the KwaZulu-Natal Social Development Minister of the Executive Committee, Mashek Radbele, who he was tasked with protecting. On March 18th last year, Kathleen Drummond opened a case of intimidation and crimen injuria after she was allegedly forced to the side of the road near the Umbumbulu off-ramp south of Durban, also on the N3, by bodyguards of Mayor Hachiweo. One of the bodyguards, who was on his way with the others to pick up Hachiweo from the airport, spat in Drummond's face through the partly open car window. Another incident happened in July last year when Lynette White, a bank teller from Queensborough in Durban, was traveling alone on the Higginson Highway to Chatsworth on her way back from a party when a white Isuzu van with a blue light came speeding toward her and pushed her off the road. She swerved into the middle lane and almost crashed into a taxi. She then went into the left lane where she hit a barrier before she could slow down. So these are the kinds of things that are going on. And most recently, a 25-year-old University of Cape Town sociology student, Khumani Maxwele, was accused of swearing or giving the finger to President Jacob Zuma's multi-vehicle cavalcade as Zuma made his way to deliver the State of the Nation address in Parliament. The man was arrested and even, according to some news accounts, taken to Zuma's residence where he was roughed up. He was released after 24 hours due to some fast work by Democratic Alliance politicians and lawyers. Maxwele said he was held for a total of 24 hours and questioned about his political affiliations and his sentiments towards Zuma. While he was in custody, national intelligence officers went to his home and searched through his belongings. Police spokesman Zuwele Nisi told the Cape Times this week that Maxwele was arrested after pointing his middle finger at the convoy in a gesture, quote, synonymous with swearing and showing disrespect. The quote continues, when police stopped to question him about his actions, he then became aggressive and began to swear at them. They then arrested him and charged him with crimen injuria and resisting arrest. The arrest has united the opposition benches. PAC president, Letlapa Motlela, called it incompatible with democracy, quote, unbecoming a free society such as ours. This has the potential of reducing this country to a banana republic by elevating the president to some sort of superhuman being and reducing the important offices in the land to Mickey Mouse proportions, unquote. The PAC, he said, was horrified by that the police had held someone for 24 hours without pressing charges for an alleged offense that wasn't a crime. There was a trend of blue light abuses, he said. In his newspaper article titled Driving in the Same Direction as Mad Bob, journalist Brendan Seary states, a few years ago, President Robert Mugabe's government amended the country's traffic legislation to make it a crime to gesture rudely or swear at his high-speed, heavily armed motorcade. When the motorcade passes, bystanders, quote, shall not make any gesture or statement within the view or hearing of the state motorcade with the intention of insulting any person traveling with an escort or any member of the escort, unquote. This is the new law. Quite why anyone would have the guts to make any such gesture, given the brutal nature of that motorcade's history, is a bit of a puzzle, Siri writes. However, it does indicate that some brave Zimbabweans are prepared to show their anger at the dictator. Mugabe's armed convoy goes back to before he became the ruler of Zimbabwe at independence in April 1980, and its establishment had its roots in the very real security threat to the president. The article continues, in Zimbabwe, unlike in South Africa, all traffic is obliged to come to a stop when the convoy approaches. This applies whether you are traveling in the same direction as the president or the opposite. The law states unambiguously, quote, the driver of every vehicle on the road on which a state motorcade is traveling shall halt his vehicle, unquote. Failure by motorists to stop has over the years resulted in a number of them being fired on by Mugabe's motorcade, and a number of people have been killed. Others have been beaten up and arrested. Wailing motorcades in South Africa are a comparatively new phenomenon. When he was still president, Nelson Mandela recounted in a TV interview how he had been asked by one of his grandchildren why he didn't have a motorcade. Mandela said he had replied, quote, oh no, we don't do that in South Africa. We leave that kind of thing to Mr. Mugabe. Molefe Ndlovu is a community activist and student based at the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban. He is a media specialist with the Durban Sings Project, and he explains here how his project came about and the extraordinary work it does.
My name is Molefe Ndlovu. I'm working at the center as a community scholar, largely responsible for doing some of the outreach work that the center is involved in. Part of the plan or the vision of the CCS is to make scholarship relevant across the lines. So finding ways to get the communities or the disadvantaged or the poor, whatever you call them, to be actively involved in the production of knowledge. And about 2 years ago, we started the idea of oral history. How to put some of the groups in Zinyati, groups in Chatsworth and other places like that who come to center activities, but we have no sense of what actually happens on site in a productive sort of exchange level. Until then, many of the groups would have to come to university activities or entertain university requests like researchers, people from outside, going into their communities with their own research questions and whatever, and then doing their research and publishing, and then they are gone. And that sort of creates a relationship that is a little bit imbalanced, where community members are expected to reveal and share everything about themselves and so on. And then the exchange, you know, the scholar or the person from the university is almost not expected to do the same. So the collaboration or the ideas that we came around with is how can we use communities' own stories to provoke or to encourage something of a creative and ongoing relationship between the center and the groups. oral history. Why? Because part of my background was I come from an experience of activism. I'm actually born in Johannesburg, raised there, and was involved with community groups and social movements there, especially the one called the Anti-Privatization Forum. And I got to be involved especially with media as a means of engaging and participation and so on. And so with indie media, where, you know, we use community activists to set up media platforms in their own communities to report about issues on their sites and so on, we got to see that media is another way that you can reach a community that's not typically active or political, in the sense that they're not, you know, they're not burning the schools and or whatever, but they have got issues that they can share and could build solidarities like that. So in Durban then, an idea was that even with the groups that we have coming to the university or for Wolpe lectures or sometimes for reality tours and so on, many of the people that do come are actually young people that are generally curious but not necessarily well-developed or articulate in the political sense or whatever. But they are also observant and they got some energies that can share. So with the oral history idea was that we draw a small pool of these young people from the different CCS connected communities that could together work out a way to find a common research agenda that they can share, and also to work out ways to common methods of getting some of this, and then also have an idea of what the ultimate goal would be. So the Durban Sings project emerged like that, where for a period of 8 months or so, we worked on a one-on-one base with some of the members of the community groups, training them around oral history. Why oral history? What is the difference between, you know, conventional academic knowledge and indigenous knowledge? Is there a difference? Those sort of things, exploring things about history, memory, and whether it can be used to build alternatives or make an intervention, things like that. And out of that, then we came up with a plan to generate, firstly, what we call a community portal. The idea behind it was to have a presence of the community groups in the actual day-to-day work of the center. If we could facilitate or support a space where other forms of relations could exist, we get each of the groups that we are involved with to have a critical, even though limited, level of technological representation in a form of a blog associated with the CCS website in a specific space. Mm-hmm. And the vision for that was that that would be the space where people could collect some of these stories, these day-to-day activities, whatever, they put them onto those platforms, and then the platforms could ultimately work to be direct contacts where ideally there is no middleman role that the CCS plays with community activism and scholarship, that we actually democratize that space altogether, where if I'm a scholar interested in urban commons and I'm able to find a space in the CCS site, whatever, where I can reach the people directly and speak to those people, it could mitigate a little bit about the types of entry and exit powers that the center has.
You're listening to Molefe Ndlovu of the Durban Sings Project, based at the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban. This is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford University, FM 90.1. And I'm Susan Gallimore, currently in South Africa, and bringing what I hope are lots of exciting ideas from the communities and progressive activists from this country. There's a lot going on here, and I'm pleased to bring such creative ideas and activities and the voices of those so dedicated to real democracy in South Africa. Let's go back to Molefe Ndlovu as he describes the Durban Sings project.
This is the second year the project has been running. And the first part, we managed to generate quite a great deal of archives, oral stories about people's names, their memories about the place when it was started, you know, just ideas about the future. We developed just a basic questionnaire and people shared in their ways. We're using audio recorders. Each of the editorial groups is responsible for their own archiving activities. So all of them have taken the raw footage and then processed it, edited it, and put it in a list, and then put it on their blog. But all of this is connected into what we call a switchboard blog site, which we call Durban Sings, where all of the work of the different editorial collectives is hosted. And from there, that's where we also make communication with other media producers and other like people on the blog, online. It's got an online presence, and then it's got the practical outreach work that we do on the site.
So if a listener wanted to go and listen to an audio file, where would they go?
When you go to the CCS website, the first thing that you will see is the Durban Sings project. We put out a call to participate, a call to contribute. And if you hit that, it will take you to the Durban Sings blog. That's where all the archives, everything is at. But even within the Durban Sings blog, you can go to individual groups now, each of their archives and so on. The project is a bit ahead of its time for the context of and the types of communities that we are working with at the moment. First and foremost, the question of internet access, the question of computer literacy, the confidence of people to share or to be able to feel that they can do work in a productive way for their own self, not necessarily working for someone else. Those sort of things are still, to a large extent, still, you know, those are the things we still need to work on and so on. But so far, you know, with limited resources, limited things, I think the groups have shown great, you know, talent, and they're still quite keen. So for this year, the plan is that each of the groups will produce something that we will all together share in a common album. We call it the Oral History Album, where each of the participating groups will have a section where they would have their bit, whatever the bit is. Others are going to do newsletters, like a pamphlet. Other groups are thinking of doing a whole book, you know, on important people in their communities and so on. Others are thinking to do oral drama, story, something like that. So all of this is all in search of ways to make the center a little bit more relevant, but also true to its ethos, where people that we are associated with are feeling as, you know, equals in a way, not necessarily seeing the center as the center on the mountain, you know. But feeling the center is almost like a deposit shelf space type of thing, not as a powerful, ordering type of thing.
That was Molefi Ndlovu, a community activist and student at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, presenting his work with the Durban Sings Project currently based at that university. He refers to the Center for Civil Society at the university, where extraordinary work goes on, including presentations by visiting scholars and reality tours. Those are two local townships and dumpway sites and so forth. And of course, to the Durban Sings Project. You can do an internet search to learn more about the Center for Civil Society and its work, and to find your way into the Durban Sings Project Molefi discusses here. We intend to bring some of the voices that Molefi Ndlovu and his group have recorded, and we will be sharing them on Raising Sand Radio in the near future. Meanwhile, go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, to see a list of all of our shows. Each one is downloadable for your listening convenience. And if you find a show that does not download, send me an email to susan@raisingsandradio.org, and we can get it to you. Raising Sand Radio is going into its third year of airing progressive shows each week from 2 to 3 Pacific time. All shows stream from KZSU and Stanford University, and you can go to the website, again, Raising Sand Radio, to find the streaming coordinates or to log on to the streaming version. Let's turn now to community leader and activist Orlean Naidu, who's based in Chatsworth and organizes Flat Dwellers there.
I'm going to relate a 12-year history. It begins as early as 1997. 3 years into the new government, the Flat Dwellers in Chatsworth found that life was difficult, you know, during the apartheid era as well, because through class divisions, the flooded communities and other shack communities were created in Chatsworth. And our particular projects were created for the disabled, the pensioners, and the low-income families. Prior to 1994, the rental, electricity, and water tariffs were extremely low. Many of the households depended on the maintenance grant that the apartheid government used to contribute towards, especially Indian and coloured families. In 1997, the government took a decision to chop off that grant by a third and redistribute it to the rest of the country, especially the black community that didn't benefit from it, which was a pretty good idea. But at the same time, they decided to then increase the tariffs on rental, electricity, and water. And many of the households in the community were barely managing with this maintenance because it was so low and were already in arrears. And with them increasing the tariffs, that would mean that people will go more into arrears than before. So by 1997, people were facing mass disconnections. During the year 1998, in Chatsworth, the flood dwellers decided to organize. So by July 1998, the same month that the maintenance grant was chopped by a third, the rental tariffs and the water and electricity tariffs increased by 10%, which meant that now, you know, people will become more imbalanced by, you know, than before. And also the larger contributing factor to the problems in the community was the fact that unemployment and poverty was on the increase. And this was largely due to the fact that many households, the impoverished households, were actually employed in the textile and leather industry. And with the collapsing of our textile and leather industry, many of our families, and in some cases, you know, double elders in the family became unemployed because many clothing industries were closing down.
Why did the textile industry collapse?
Well, this was due to, you know, South Africa opening its doors to imports and exports. And that was the big contributing factor to why our clothing and textile industry collapsed.
So the jobs went elsewhere.
Absolutely. We were importing cheaper goods and stuff like that, and our clothing and textile industry was at a huge challenge. Many households now found themselves unemployed. While the incomes were being reduced, the tariffs were increasing. And we found that there was a definite need to now start organizing in the community. So in July 1998 was the first time we found ourselves organizing and going in on protest in South Africa. Now, I want to just speak a little bit about myself. I lived in a middle-class home, in a more middle-class suburb. Chatsworth, it's an urban community. I lived in a middle-class home. My father was a boarding contractor, earned pretty good money, lived in a home where we had a car. We never knew what poverty was like. But I married into a family that was impoverished. And when I got married, I started to understand what it is to be poor. And that is how, through my husband not having a good income, I moved into this community with him. So coming from a middle-class background, you don't understand what poverty is. But moving into this community, we started to realize, you know, that people are really poor and you know, they can't afford to pay. Now, let me just say that in Chatsworth, you would find that there are mushrooms of poor communities that don't really communicate across the class line. You'd find that middle-class communities are restricted to their households, all fenced up, drive into your driveway, never consider what happens to your neighbor. But when I moved into this community, it was a true sense of community because people were caring and sharing with each other. People didn't have food to eat and they were dependent on their neighbors. When your electricity was disconnected, your neighbor would actually contribute towards you. Then we started to face our first eviction. A woman, single-headed household, was given an eviction notice. And her particular case was that her husband had abandoned the family almost a year ago. He had gone, migrated into the country to do, you know, to go and sell linen and stuff and earn some money, but never arrived home. And she was in serious arrears and was facing an eviction. And based on getting that summon from the court, she then took overdose, and the entire community started rallying around that. On that basis, we decided that we as a community need to start organizing and doing something about it. So on the 4th of July was the first time we sent a letter to the municipal officials, very local right in Chatswood, requesting a meeting so that we make them understand what our position was. And when we arrived at that meeting, we found ourselves, you know, in the midst of many middle-class people, you know, actually not accepting what we were telling them. And we had to leave the meeting. By the 4th of July was the first time we mobilized at least 1,000 people and went on protest. At that meeting, we issued a memorandum saying that we request a meeting with the housing director because we needed people to take us seriously around our grievances. And we thought they were very legitimate. Some of our grievances were that the tariffs were too high. We compared with other communities that were paying lighter tariffs than ourselves. The issue was the tariffs were too high. Also, there was a disparity across the Tikwene region as far as charging people rental and electricity tariffs. We also said our dwellings were outlived their shelf life by then and were in a dilapidated state, and we needed them to do repairs and maintenance. So there were several issues that we raised. By August, we managed to get a meeting with the director of housing, and for the second time, 3,000 people from Chatsworth marched to the city hall. Since then, we have gone through a range of meetings and engagements and protests, only to be sent back and said, we don't want to talk to you, you should go through a separate group where civics meet and discuss their issues. And if that group thinks your issues are realistic, they must then bring it to the table and then councillors will look at it and it will go then to an official level. When we met with this group for the very first time, we found that they were a toothless body that only served the interests of those that could afford, never served the interests of people that were living below the breadline. And we obviously resented going to that meeting. We showed our grievance through a letter saying that we would not attend those meetings. And we then went on serious protests. Actually, when we went to the city hall to meet the director of housing, on that particular day, we declared defiance. And we said, as of today, we're not going to pay the city a penny until our grievances are taken seriously. So since 1998, we've been to and forth. And by 1999, we started facing mass disconnections where they would come in and disconnect hundreds of people in different communities around Chatsworth. Now in Chatsworth, there are four flatted communities and all of the communities we organized together. We had little community-based organizations within the organizations. But when we attended meetings like an umbrella body, Flat Dwellers of Chatsworth, which was the umbrella body. We found ourselves facing mass disconnections in all of the communities. It was a big challenge, but we mobilized people quickly and we managed to resist the disconnections. Initially, what we used to do is the minute they come to disconnect one household, we would quickly mobilize people and actually physically chase them away. Mm-hmm. Then we found that they increased their force. Second round, when they started coming for disconnection, they started bringing in heavily armed security. So they would come in with big machine guns and rifles, and people were obviously scared. And if you look at the organization, especially our organization, at least 80% of our organization are women. And when it came to resisting evictions, you would find that because we have so many female-headed households, there were more women and children resisting than men. And we didn't want our people to get hurt. So what we would do is quietly stand on the wayside, let them disconnect. As soon as they leave, we would go back and reconnect. That was our tactic.
So reconnecting was something that you could easily do?
Through the process, we actually learned reconnections. They would try any trick in the book and we would have it undone. By the third round of disconnections, what happened was, the minute you went into arrears, there was interest charges and reconnection fees. By the second time they would come to disconnect that household, they now were imposing interest charges, reconnection fees and tampering fees. And the tampering fees was pretty high. It was 820 rand each time they would disconnect you. And if possible, they would disconnect, especially us like leaders, three times or four times a week. So they target the leaders and then they disconnect you every second day. So by the time they started disconnecting, they first imposed all of this extraordinary charges on your bill. And we asked people to disregard that. and not to fear, we continue without resistance. But what they did was they actually came and removed all of the cables. Then we started to use our own funding, and we'd buy cables and reconnect people. So people were back on the system connecting. By the fourth time, they started actually removing switches and the meter box itself. So they would come in, move your meter box and stuff like that. Then we researched the whole thing and we said, better still, because now they'll never know how much of electricity you're using. All we would do is go to the hardware, buy a breaker, install it, you have a switch and you have electricity. So we'd connect you direct. We went on to frustrating them to a limit when actually on one particular day, an entire block of flats was not paying. And when arrears, they came and actually disconnected the entire block of flat. And in the process of disconnecting, they removed all of the cables, even underground. We went further, used all our experience, and we managed to connect the one flat from the one flat to the other. So we managed to eventually get this flat connected. We had frustrated them to a level that they now came in and they started mass disconnections with water. So the first step was electricity. While still pursuing the disconnections on electricity, they then started disconnecting water, and that was quite serious. Same with water. We would go in, we would reconnect. Then they introduced the trickler system. We challenged them on water. In 2000, we took a case to the High Court, Christina's case to the High Court. We won the interdict, but we lost the case. We lost the case on the basis that Christina was giving too much water to our other neighbors that were disconnected, that there were 10,000 other households in the same situation as Christina, and if they gave Christina relief in the case, it would cause anarchy. The city couldn't provide for the other 10,000 people. And also that there was no policy guaranteeing free water. But as a community, we never stopped mobilizing and we never stopped reconnecting. So over and above losing the case, we continued with our reconnections. The same with water. They introduced the trickler, and on challenging them legally, they said that was a system that would provide you water in trickles. It would take you maybe half an hour to fill a liter of water because it comes in drips. And if you were living on the second floor, you wouldn't get any drips at all because there's no pressure flow and the drip couldn't actually reach the upstairs. So what we do with the trickler, it was so simple. We just removed the trickler, widened the hole. It was like a 2-cent coin with a tiny pinhole. So the water would actually go in drips through that pinhole. It was so simple that we'll actually move out the trip. The minute they put in the trickler, we go there, we'll remove it, we'll widen the hole, we'll put it back into the meter. So we never tamper with the meter because the trickler is still there. We frustrated them there even where they came and removed meters, they removed pipes, they did all of the nonsense. We still managed to keep all people connected. We would exclude the meter but reconnect people directly. About 3 years ago, they introduced the flow limiter. And the flow limiter was actually designed to give people the limited amount of water for the day. The free water for the day, the 200 liters. Some of our households, because the pamphlet was so well designed and was sent around, they said, come to the water department, sign an acknowledgement of death and get free water, without telling people how much of free water you're getting. So some of our tenants, without realizing, what the consequences were, went to the workshop that in the room they would have 50 to 100 people. They would give you a workshop, even if you're not literate enough to understand. You then go and sign an acknowledgement of death, and they would come back and install this meter. One Saturday afternoon, we were called by one of the tenants saying, my water's cut off, only to realize when we went to this household that she had actually gone and signed the acknowledgement of death. She has the meter. But the way the meter operated was that it gave you water at 5:30 in the morning. And if you consumed that 200 liters by 6 o'clock, you were cut off completely. There's no other water. It would cut you off completely. We then went and bypassed that system as well.
If you're just tuning in, this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU FM 90.1, Stanford University, with Orlean Naidoo telling remarkable stories of resistance by the economically disadvantaged flat dwellers of Chatsworth. They're resisting the Durban municipality's raising of electricity and water tariffs to a point that the entire community was in arrears. As we hear from Orlean Naidoo, the flat dwellers have consistently stood up against bullying tactics by the Durban municipality. In the following segment, Orlean Naidoo outlines the political structures that their community works within?
We started struggling since 1998, and by 2004, we were getting some kind of engagement from the municipality. It was very close to national elections. The ANC wanted some extra votes in Chatsworth, so they pitch up one fancy day in Bayview, hire a community org, and they want to discuss upgrading in Bayview. And they exclude the organizers in the community, the Bayview Flat Residents Association, from this particular meeting. They're not invited, but they're discussing the upgrading of the flats in Bayview. So a few of us pitch up at that meeting. Derek Naidu, the deputy city manager, is at this meeting, and he's bragging about all the flat dwellers are going to get their flats upgraded. We barge into the meeting, accuse him of not consulting the community, but more especially make reflection to his own involvement during the apartheid era. And Derek Naidu, if you know, is the man that actually was involved in bombing Raj Bansi's house. Now, Raj Bansi is the leader of the Minority Front, and he was a part of the Natal Union Congress, sold out the ANC and everybody else to create a relationship with the apartheid government so that he could get Indian houses built in Chatsworth, Phoenix, Mirbank, and the rest of it. So during the apartheid era, his house was bombed by certain members of the ANC because of the way he sold out, you know, people that were in struggle. And we brought all of this to his notice. We're saying, you are conducting the same kind of behavior in our community without consulting us. That meeting was called off, and since 2004, a public meeting was called by the municipality itself, where all of the flooded communities were brought to a meeting. Members were elected, and a Chatsworth Steering Committee was elected. So each of the community groups has a steering committee through the processes of the municipality elected in their specific communities. And then as an umbrella body, the Chatsworth Steering Committee, we have then gone and engaged with the municipality. We have gone through a long process of engagement. We had the first round of upgrading where they did underpinning and drainage. Funding was very badly used. We are still in serious disputes with the municipality over how that funding was used, because they, part of the first upgrading, they did plumbing. I think it's about 4 years now since that upgrading was done. It's already in a total state of disrepair, and we have serious disputes with the municipality around that. So the upgrading has gone on, and for the 2 years that the upgrading was in process, we didn't have any engagements around electricity and water. And people were still reconnecting illegally. By 2006, they then moved into Bayview, and they did a complete upgrading now on the electrical. So they went in and they started putting new switches, complete new cables. They removed all of the old cables, they put in new cables. Initially, when the project of the upgrading started, people were told that, you know, we are giving you new switches and stuff like that. The cables are old, they outlived their shelf life, we are just renewing all of your electrical. On that basis, it was accepted. Only to realize in January 2007 that thinking behind it was that we would renew all of the cables and introduce the prepaid for electricity. So in February 2007, the municipality moves in without even consulting, even though there's a steering committee in place. They don't consult, they come in and install prepaid meters on two blocks of flats. And the price of each of the prepaid meters is 1,000 rands. So they come in, 12 families are installed with prepaid meters. We go on the rampage on that day. Because we were not consulted, because tenants were not educated, and we were not accepting prepaid meters. The ironical thing is that on the Sunday, we have a public meeting between all of the communities. And we invite our councillors, the respective councillors in all of those communities. And we announce it very clearly. The meeting starts at about 12 and ends up at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And our councillors are sitting in the front row of the meeting, thinking that they're going to be given a platform at some time to speak. We just keep them there, you know, with that kind of feeling. By 4:30, we then declare to the councillors that prepaid meters will not be accepted by our communities. And on Monday morning, prepaid meters are actually installed in the community. So we forcefully ask them to remove the prepaid meters or we damage them. They take the prepaid meters and leave. An hour later, they come in and they disconnect 10 blocks of flats in Bayview at the substation. 10 tenants within those 10 flats are actually paid-up tenants and should never be disconnected. But also through the process of upgrading, they assure tenants that they will not be disconnected. So through the process of upgrading, they actually went and connected tenants legally, even though they were not paying. Now, in order for them to disconnect, they ought to have given us notification. So one of our friend lawyers, we consulted with him, and he told us that it was illegal for them to, to come and disconnect us. Based on that fact, we took the city to task. We have Derek Nader on the telephone and we at a public meeting in Bayview. The community is saying we don't want the prepaid meters. We will do anything in our power to get electricity tonight. And Derek Nader on the other side is saying, accept the prepaid meters and I will connect you now. So while this conflict is ongoing telephonically, we then decide to pack the buses and go to the councillor's house. So we pitch up at the councillor's house, 300 people, very arrogant, screaming, shouting, chanting slogans. We find all of the police, chats with SAPS and the Metro Police arrive there. And we very nicely tell them, we just elected our councillor. We told him on Sunday that we don't want the prepaid meters. He was part and parcel of us getting the prepaid meters today. All we're asking for him to ask the city to reconnect us. The councillor was so scared he never came out of his house. But thankfully, the police were on our side. They managed to get contacts with the deputy city manager, and at 10 o'clock in the night, the lights were switched on. And we were asked in February 2007 to meet with city officials. And this is electricity, water, the deputy city manager, and housing officials. We arrive at the meeting in 2007. We sit around the table, and our first request to the city is that if we want to engage in good faith, we want a moratorium on evictions and disconnections. Otherwise, we are not discussing this matter further. Since February 2007, there is a moratorium on evictions and disconnections in Chatsworth. And up until today, nobody has been disconnected. 82% of our community has not paid a penny since 1998. Since we declared defiance, nobody has paid a penny. For the last year, we've been connected to prepaid meters, unfortunately, and that is through a lengthy process of consultations. We first, as a steering committee, were workshopped around the prepaid meters. We had intensive discussions. We dealt with the old issue of tariffs, and we were told that the charges on the prepaid and whether you remain on credit meters are the same, so there's no extra charges on being on the prepaid. We dealt with the old issue of estimations. When you're on the credit meter, they read your meter once in 3 months, and they charge you for 2 months on an estimated basis. So when they read your meter on the third month and they think this is your amount, they use an estimation to charge you for the other 2 months that they don't read. And we found in many cases that the estimations are not properly calculated and people are not even being reimbursed. So based on some of these kinds of facts, and also proper workshops and consultation, what happened through the process was we had the electricity, housing and water department do 18 workshops in each community. That means we brought about 40 tenants each time into a meeting, and they dealt with every issue thoroughly. And there was, you know, question and answer sessions and stuff like that. So we dealt with all the issues of electricity, water, the upgrading, the issue of ownership. We're still pursuing all of that. And then we went on to actually bringing in officials into the community to do sign-ups as well. So the officials came to households in the community for the third time now. First was a consultation with the steering committee. The second consultation was with the tenants themselves in a group. And the third consultation was an official actually coming to your house, explaining the whole process again, and then finally asking you whether you want it or not. So that process of consultation has gone through, and people are now connected to the prepaid meter. So we have at least 80% of the community now connected. But prior to being connected, we made sure that there was a vending station in the vicinity so that people didn't have to pay extra and additional bus fares. Ongoing, we are still discussing all our disputes and grievances. With the upgrading, with the prepaid meter, with the vending station, it is ongoing. We never leave a stone unturned. We find that the vending station is always offline. And you find that people have to pay extra bus fares and go. And we're telling the city this is not acceptable. So people are on the electricity. We are prepaid for electricity. It's extremely high. People are not managing. And this is something that we are seriously talking to the city about. We would be forced to reconnect. And we are telling them this if an alternative is not found. Because people are actually buying 10 rand and using for 2 days. The consumption levels have dropped drastically. We have a serious, serious problem with the upgrading. They've actually reduced our external breaker from a 60 watt to a 40 watt. And this is causing serious, serious trip-offs. You'd find that when you consume more than 40 watts at a time, you'll have a trip-off on the external. And through the process of it tripping off, the switches are burning, the DBs are burning. Yesterday we brought an inspector into the community, had thorough inspections, and they're going to be making representation. We are forcing the city to put back the 60-watt breaker.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore, host of this weekly hour-long show, sharing the voices and ideas of community leaders based at the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. As we will hear from Orlean Naidu of Chatsworth in South Durban, community residents have become adept at working with water and electricity supplies, and I asked whether there had been any accidents or fires.
We had one incident very early this year. At 10 o'clock in the night, the entire flat was blacked out because all of the main cables burnt off. There was actually huge sounds of, like bomb sounds in the power room. The power room is actually externally, and everybody's connections is in this one room. We had to call out an engineer that night, and he came and repaired it. But we are actually at our meetings requesting investigations on why this happened. Mm-hmm. So we are very stern on taking every single, even the lightest issue, and requesting some kind of investigation and inquiry report. We've gone to that extent this year because as much as, some of us have been so excited about upgrading, about, getting things changed and life becoming better, through the process, there's a lot of corruption, I must just say this. Mm. There's a lot of corruption. We're already on our upgrading project, had our projects manager suspended. We had our housing manager was in charge of the upgrading project in Chatsworth suspended. So these are serious issues, and when we ask for questions, no answers as yet, believe me. They say they only suspended, it's still pending investigation. So there are serious, serious problems, even though upgrading is happening. Certain things might be positive, but there's a lot of negative issues that we are keeping a very, very close eye on. We started having water workshops, and we anticipated this going to the end of March and coming out with a beautiful report. But unfortunately, last night, I had to bring all of that to a dead stop. Now, the reason why we suspended the workshops on that we're having through the water department, and Neil McLeod is saying it very nicely here, that we are moving into scarcity, that residential is overusing and wasting, and that we should save water, which is not a reality. We had our plumbing upgrading done, and like I said before, it is in a total state of disrepair. Almost every single household is suffering with water tap leaks, external pipe leaks and stuff like that, and all this is contributing to high bills. Now I'm saying, why are we preaching and saying that you're getting 9 free and your tariffs are going to be lower, and you're having your pipes repaired and stuff like this, people are actually paying extra because of the leaks. So we're saying as much as you're going to come there and teach people on how to consume and save water, they're not actually wasting the water. The water is wasted through your process of upgrading and substandard work. So in no uncertain terms, I said to the city, all workshops will come to a standstill unless the issue of the plumbing is dealt with. We will resume whatever we have started. So we're sitting here and we're preaching to our tenants about saving water while water is getting wasted through leaks. It's unacceptable. It is your responsibility. Please take care of it and we'll resume with our workshops again. So that is where we are with water. But let me just say that the water department also will seem to have a little bit of a friendly approach. we are being used as a pilot project, and in many instances we are a kind of a priority case because not everybody in the city has a moratorium. But we have the moratorium that is one, so people will never get disconnected. The second thing that we thoroughly fought from the inception was the bill itself, the consolidated bill. We found that the consolidated bill was extremely high, and that's why people fell into arrears. We were billed for housing, that is your rental, your general lighting charges, your municipal rates, that is sewer and refuse removal. And then over and above that, you had electricity and you had your water on one bill. So people could not prioritize and pay. And the consolidated bill was extremely high, in a way that people couldn't afford to pay at the end of the month. So if you didn't pay your consolidated bill, they would first disconnect you from electricity. And if you continue not to pay by the second month, you had interest charges, you had reconnection charges, the bill just escalated more. And if you continued not to pay, then you were disconnected and finally you would be on an eviction list. So with water and electricity, now that we're on prepaid, we don't get a bill for electricity. So people would just buy their voucher, use it and monitor. With water, we requested that we have a separate bill from housing. People are using water. It's a challenge. They can't afford to pay. And I pray and hope that the free will increase even more so that everybody, would get water free at some point. But with the water department, we signed the debt relief, and that was done in the community as well. And the debt relief is a policy which people can benefit from, especially poor people. If you are in arrears for more than 3 months, I think it is, and if your property value is below 190,000, you qualify for the debt relief. And the debt relief is actually a policy where you sign a 20-month contract with the water department. And for each time you pay your current bill on time and in full, you would get 1/20th of your arrears written off. Now, over and above that, for many years, at least for about 5 years, I have been fighting with the water department over a very extraordinary charge, extremely high charge on the bill, which is the water fixed charge. I think it's much more than the actual consumption charge in many instances. Now, through all the work that I've been doing and the monitoring, people have a consumption charge of 20 rand, but the water fix is actually 88 rand. And then the bill is extremely high because of the water fix and the water loss. Also, there's a ruling with the water loss insurance. If your meter is above the ground, you do not pay for water loss insurance because you can monitor the leak and stuff like that. Now, all of these charges, even though legally we shouldn't be paying it, we have been charged for all of these years. So what the water department has gone and done is they consolidated everybody's arrears, including all of the extraordinary charges and all of that, and it's parked off for 20 months. In the process of you paying your current bill, 1/20th of that will be written off. But what has happened is because they could not correct the information on the system, people are still presently being charged water fix and water loss. But because of our engagement with the municipality, we were advised to advise tenants individually on what they should pay. So even though people's bills will read arrears the following month, they should only be paying the actual consumption plus 14% VAT. And in many, many cases, I must just say that people are not paying bills anymore for water. They have introduced the flow limiters on a very small scale. The initial flow limiters would restrict you to just the free basic. But because of our engagement, they've gone a step further into saying the tenant, they only went on the flow limiter with their, with them choosing to stay. Even though you had thousands of rounds of arrears, you are allowed to go on the free access to water. Now, those people that chose the flow limiters, I would say it's about maybe 10% in the community. Many of them were very problematic and done away with when they were installed. So slowly but surely, the flow limiters are being undone as well.
That was Orlean Naidu, a Chatsworth-based community leader who organizes flat dwellers in that residential community. Again, Orlean Naidu is a community researcher at the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, as is Molefi Ndlovu, who we heard from earlier. I must say that bringing the work of Malefi and Orlean to the airwaves gives me an enormous amount of pleasure, particularly these days when it may seem that the world is heading to hell in a handbasket. There are many people out there toiling away quietly and very firmly to reverse that course. This is particularly true in South Africa, where there is a growing resistance to the neoliberal trend in this country. As we heard at the beginning of the show, there is a growing heavy-handedness to this resistance also, and the future here is hard to predict. Meanwhile, there is a growing resistance to the World Bank's multi-billion US dollar loan to assist South African parastatal Eskom to build new coal-fired power plants. In the last weeks, Raising Sand Radio has aired voices and stories from that issue, and I encourage you to get more involved and learn more. Go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, for a good overview of these issues. And again, we've been airing them the last couple of weeks. And that is our show for this week. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the host and guests, and not KZSU or Stanford University. Tune in again next week to listen live on Pacific Time, Monday from 2 to 3 at Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. You can go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, to listen to our internet streaming, or simply download any of our shows at your convenience. Again, the website is raisingsandradio.org. You can also email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org to comment on any of our shows or suggest topics for future shows. Let's go out with a little more blues.
Cheeseburger.